never know.
What? Where?
Okay, now that we're done having our Bill Gates induced technical difficulty. So to finish a conversation we had last time about liquid crystal displays and how they work, liquid crystal displays use polarizers. So you know that if I have a polarizer, polarized in one direction, it'll only let through light that's polarized in that direction. Okay? And then if I put on top of it a polarizer that's crossed the other way, I put that on top of that, nothing will come through. Right? So this is how your liquid crystal displays are set up. They have a backlight, they have a polarizer at the backlight, and then at the front of the screen there's a crossed polarizer. And then you put in between here liquid crystals, and the liquid crystal is in one of those twisted pneumatic phases, where the pneumatic means that the long molecules choose a particular direction, but twisted means they're going to rotate as you advance in the material. So they'll twist as they go along. So let's see. Well, it's almost impossible to draw, but you know what I'm saying, right? I'm going to have one layer has it mostly pointing this direction, the next layer up has it tilted just a little bit, the next layer up tilted just a little, and so on. So what happens when you put that twisted pneumatic liquid crystal in between is as light passes through here, the liquid crystal itself twists the polarization so that it can get out. Okay? And this is the relaxed state. If you have that type of liquid crystal, it tends to twist as it goes up. So it's a twisted pneumatic. And in the relaxed state, it'll twist the polarization so that light gets out and you can see the pixel. There's your eye. Okay, and then when you apply a field, a voltage, what you'll do is you'll untwist the pneumatic, because you'll tend to polarize it completely. You'll tend to orient it all in one direction. So let's say we apply the field this way, that orients them all this way. Well, now no light can get through. So when it's relaxed, light comes through. When you apply this, no light comes through. And that's what the liquid crystal is doing in a computer screen.
Can you apply to varying strengths so you allow different frequencies to play through?
Or oh, the way they do the color is they'll put a little color. So for each pixel, if this is one pixel, they'll have three color shields in front of it.
Okay. Red, blue, and green.
So it's still just an on-off. Most of them are that way. Yeah?
Why people are so crazy about the liquid crystal display? What is good on the liquid crystal display?
Yeah, I like mine because they're nice and skinny, and yeah, they have nice high resolution.
And they're not shooting electrons out at you.
It also cooler. Because, like, seriously, if you have, like, five screens in front of you, it gets hot.
Ah, so they don't emit as much heat. Mm-hmm. I hate the sound of CRT tubes myself. I can hear that high-pitched whine that they make. It irritates me to death.
Okay, thanks for the demo.
Can always count on physics majors to be ready and willing to produce sound effects on demand.
If you put a magnet next to an LCD, will it mess it up?
Probably. But I don't want to try it with my computer. You can try it with your computer.
Try it with that one.
Yeah.
You won't even notice it.
So here's. Here's different liquid crystals. I just thought I'd go to lecture demos and pull out whatever liquid crystals they could play with. These guys are thermotropic, that is, they change based on the temperature. So there's a very thin layer of liquid crystal in there, and then depending on its temperature, it has different interference effects. And you're used to thin films having interference effects, and then as a function of temperature, the interference effects change. So play with that, see how cold your fingers are. When I first came into work today, and I went straight to lecture demos, and walking around outside, I said, great, can I have some? And of course, it looked like I was dead, because I was too cold.
This may be completely unrelated, but does anybody else remember those t-shirts that used to change colors?
Yeah.
Or like
I don't know, did those work with...
How did I miss those?
What
it was like the early 90s.
How did
I was in college. I was working really hard.
No.
I need a t-shirt that changes color. That's cool.
I don't know. They do like finger polishes that change color and bracelets that change color.
Like mood rings?
So it's still all liquid crystals.
I don't know what the nail polish is doing or the other stuff is doing.
That's okay.
The mood rings and the bracelets would be doing this.
Okay. So, like, how does it do interference? Like, does the heat change the orientation of the little liquid?
I don't know what the details are of this guy.
Okay.
But I can look them up and find them for you. Yeah. I just thought I'd find whatever lecture demos had that was. Are you alive?
So, wait, this was outside this morning?
I'm sorry, what?
Outside,
no, I was outside this morning walking around and my hands got a cold, and then I went to lecture demo and I said, give me all your liquid crystals. And they complied. And of course, my hands were too cold to affect it, so it was kind of sad. I know, everybody needs that mouse pad now. Actually, you can't go to lecture demo. Sorry.
What?
There's a cool sign that says staff only. I don't know what happens if you're not staff and you pass through that sign, but I wouldn't try it.
Is that room behind you, this 114?
Yeah, this. If you want to do an outreach, though, presentation to high school students and middle school students, then you get to go play with the lecture demos and pick out what, you know, the stuff you're going to do. So go talk to the outreach. Pretend?
But
I think they know.
Considering.
They know. They're really smart. They have ways of knowing. So last time, excuse me, last time we talked about the kinetic model of mass action. Okay, so mass action, right, is about chemical reactions. And it's about what's the equilibrium concentrations of everything. So we talked about what's the time dependence of these chemical reactions. And we looked at, you know, the fact that you could use a catalyst to speed things up. And we saw that if we analyzed the rate of change at which, you know, two atoms come together and form a new molecule, and the rate at which that molecule then dissociates, if we looked at that, we get the exact same answer for the relative concentrations in equilibrium that we got just using thermodynamics. That is, that the relative concentrations only depend on temperature. So everything makes sense. Whether you look at things microscopically in a time-dependent manner or just look with thermodynamics, things will make sense. We looked at catalysts as well. We calculated what's called the Clausius-Clapeyron equation for vaporization. So here we said, all right, if I have... What you're looking for there is, where's the phase boundary between liquid and gas? You know you can have a phase transition between liquid and gas. So what you're looking for, you know, where's that phase boundary? And there are three conditions we put on equilibrium. We say that in two phases that are in contact and in equilibrium with each other have to have the same chemical potential, the same pressure, and the same temperature. So here we put all those together in one equation because the chemical potential is a function of pressure and temperature. So that's all your conditions all rolled into one. The liquid chemical potential at that pressure and temperature is equal to the gas chemical potential at that pressure and temperature. That tells you where the phase boundary is. And if you move off of that, then you're off of the phase boundary. So using this, remember we set the liquid chemical potential equal to the gas chemical potential, and then we took Taylor expansions like we always do. We said we're going to make small moves along this phase boundary line. And as we do that, we can make Taylor expansions. And we derive this equation that dp by dt, the slope of the line at any given point, equals the latent heat of vaporization divided by whatever temperature you're at, also divided by the change in volume. Okay. So that's how we got the Clausius-Clapeyron equation last time. Today, we're going to talk about solid gas sublimation. So this is taking something from the solid phase directly into the gas phase. We'll see that we can put the same type of equilibrium considerations on that. We'll also get into van der Waals forces and the van der Waals equation of state. So what this means is that we'll take the ideal gas law, PV equals n tau, which had a few assumptions on it, and we'll correct those assumptions a little bit and see how the ideal gas law changes. So it'll have slight corrections to it based on making those assumptions, relaxing those assumptions a little bit. And then we'll also talk about van der Waals forces, and here's a hint that at the end of lecture we're going to talk about geckos because they're related to van der Waals forces. So here, for example, is dry ice sublimating. I'm sure most of you have played with dry ice. So it's frozen CO2, and then it can, at ambient pressure, and it'll go directly from the solid phase to the gas phase. So this is just a picture of dry ice sublimation. And the conditions for equilibrium, like we said, are you want the temperatures, basically this is for two phases in contact. And here we have two phases in contact. We have the solid part and the gas part both in contact. For them to be in equilibrium with each other, they need to be in thermal equilibrium, mechanical equilibrium, and diffusive equilibrium. So thermal equilibrium means the temperatures are the same. Mechanical equilibrium means the pressures are the same. One is not pushing more on the other one than the other is pushing back. Diffusive equilibrium means that they trade an equal number of particles. So if they're in diffusive contact, they can trade particles. When the chemical potentials are equal, for every particle that gets traded one way, another one gets traded back. Okay, so those processes are continually happening. It's just that it's in a steady state so that there's no net change in one direction or the other. So those are all the conditions on equilibrium that we're going to need. Oh, question. Sorry, you were kind of tentative about that. I thought you were...
It's not really relevant, but is there anything that will superconduct the dry ice?
I don't know what dry ice temperature is. I don't think dry ice is cold enough. Liquid nitrogen is cold enough. Does anybody remember what's dry ice temperature? I don't remember. Okay, so high temperature superconductors generally work around 100 Kelvin, and some of them under pressure can work up to 160 Kelvin. So there's your cutoff. Yeah, I don't know. So let's take a simple model for watching the sublimation here. And I'm going to assume that in the solid, the right energy spectrum is to say that each atom in the solid is a little harmonic oscillator. And the reason that's okay is because inside of the solid, each atom has its equilibrium position, and it can move a little bit away from that equilibrium position. So if I reach inside the solid and I pull one atom slightly to the left or something like that, then if I let it go, it'll oscillate back and forth around its equilibrium position. So they're little harmonic oscillators, and harmonic oscillators, you know, have the spectrum where you go above the ground state by adding successively H bar omega, where omega is the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So we'll add n H bar omega for every quanta n that's in the harmonic oscillator. Now I'm going to oversimplify and pretend we're looking at a one-dimensional solid. So this is not entirely correct, but it's going to make the math here a little bit simpler on the partition function, and you'll get the basic idea of what you're supposed to do with this. I should remind you that we'll pretend we have a solid in one dimension. We actually know that solids can't exist in one dimension, okay? And it's because it's too easy to break them. If I think of a solid in two and three dimensions as being all the atoms, you know, we could demonstrate this with people if people had enough arms, but they don't. So, you know, if people had, you know, six arms, right, one for each axis, two for each axis in space, then you could make this crystal of people, right, just like you can make a three-dimensional crystal where the atom is, you know, connecting above and below, right and left and side to side, right? Now, if you think about what thermal fluctuations do to those chemical bonds, the thermal fluctuations can basically break those bonds randomly once in a while, okay? If you have a three-dimensional crystal, you're breaking bonds and, the bonds, you know, break and then come back together, for example. Think about it in that way. So if I just break a bond once in a while and it comes back together, break a bond once in a while and it comes back together, if it's a three-dimensional crystal, no problem. It won't fall apart when you do that. If it's a two-dimensional crystal, the fluctuations will be a little bit more severe. It'll cause more wiggles to happen, but the crystal can still exist. If you do that in one dimension, if I have a one-dimensional chain of chemical bonds like this and I break one of the chemical bonds, I just broke the whole crystal. It's gone, okay? And another chemical fluctuation will happen over here, and it'll break the bond and break up the chain. So I just want to be honest here and say, look, we're pretending the solid is in 1D. You technically can't even get a solid in one dimension. If there was only one dimension, your solid couldn't exist. But we'll approximate the math that way because it'll make our lives easier and still illustrate the same physics. So what we need is the partition function. Okay, so we'll take the partition function for a single oscillator in the solid. Actually, I'm going to be working in the single particle regime for this whole thing. I'll just look at what's the thermodynamics, the statistical mechanics and thermodynamics of a single particle in the solid. Now, the partition function, of course, is the sum over available states, e to the minus energy over tau. So here's the energy that we set up. The energy is minus E naught, so some sort of ground state, plus NH bar omega. So here I simply sum over E to the minus those energies divided by temperature. Yeah?
Each of N atoms is for one atom or all the atoms? I'm just learning from the same equation.
Oh, okay. So what I mean is that I'm going to write down equations for one atom at a time.
Okay.
But each atom follows the same equation. Okay. All right. So I'll zoom in and concentrate on one atom. But yeah, there's the same equations are applied to each atom. So here's the partition function. I can pull out the ground state energy. E to the minus minus epsilon naught over tau becomes an e to the plus epsilon naught over tau. And then I have the sum over n, e to the minus nh bar omega over tau. I know you remember how to do this, right? Sum over, and I have this. This is one of those infinite series that's worth putting in your brain, which is that the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of x to the n is 1 over 1 minus x for x small, okay, x less than 1. So definitely put that in your brain. And that helps us to solve this partition function. So now we know what the partition function looks like. Okay, question? Got it? Okay. All right, so the partition function for one atom is e to the epsilon naught over tau divided by 1 minus e to the minus h bar omega over tau. Okay, we solve that. And then the free energy of one oscillator, we can get directly from the partition function, free energy, is minus tau log Zs. What happened to my n? Let's see if there's an n there. Yeah, thank you, n equals 1. So I'm looking at one atom, so I've set n equals 1. Okay, so each of these equations is really the single atom case. So now the free energy for one atom is minus tau log of Zs. Now, the Gibbs free energy is really what we need for the conditions we're considering, okay, where temperature and pressure are going to be controlled as we do the phase transition. So I really need to look at the Gibbs free energy. And again, I'm going to look in the per atom case. So the Gibbs free energy is Helmholtz free energy plus P times the volume of the solid here. Okay, so I'm looking at the Gibbs free energy per atom in the solid. It's the Helmholtz free energy plus PV. This is a little v to denote that I divided by n, okay? So it really means the specific volume, which is the volume, you know, the average volume per atom inside the solid. Now, I didn't show you, well, okay. So this mu s here, I know that this is true because the Gibbs free energy is always mu times n, and I've set n equal to 1. So all of this is equal to mu sub s. And then what I'm going to argue on the other side is that I can throw out this term because the volume per atom is so small inside the solid. Are there any questions so far? Got it? Just looking at the Gibbs free energy for a single atom inside the solid. So here's where we are. We calculated the partition function. We know this is the Gibbs free energy per atom inside the solid. And they have to be at the same pressure, okay, because that's part of the conditions of the problem we're going to be in mechanical equilibrium between the two different phases. So the pressure of the gas equals the pressure of the solid, and then I'm just going to call them both P, okay, so the overall pressure. And if the gas is ideal, okay, if the gas is ideal, and I have PV equals N tau, or if I'm looking at the ideal gas relation for a single atom, okay, if I take then the volume per particle, then I can write that as a little g, the specific volume of the gas. So then I get P times little v is tau, or I can convert the pressure into tau over little v. So now I can substitute this relation for the pressure. Okay, this is the relation for the pressure in the ideal gas, but it is the pressure, and the pressure is the same in the solid. Does that concept of a pressure in a solid make sense? I hope. Okay, you know, for example, the table has a particular pressure inside of it because there's an air pressure, right? So there's a force per area pressing on the table. there's a force per area pressing on the table down here and from every side. And since the table's not moving and not contracting, the table's pushing back with the exact same force per area. Therefore, that pressure must exist inside the table too. Okay, so all over the table, there's the same force per area inside it as there is in the air. So same thing here, there's a particular pressure inside the solid, and that pressure has to be in equilibrium with the gas. So then the pressure is tau over Vg. So I'll just plug that in here, okay? So I plug that in. Now the Gibbs free energy is the Helmholtz free energy plus, now I've plugged in the pressure relation, and I get a Vs over Vg, okay? Where this is the volume per atom of the solid, and this is the volume per atom of the gas. Now, since this is a solid to gas transition, the volume that the gas takes up is huge compared to the volume of the solid. Okay, so I can neglect this term here, basically. N, oh, I shouldn't have put an N there, should I? N is 1. So you might want to put that in your notes, that big N right there. Really, I should have had a 1 right there. Big N is 1 in a Gibbs free energy per atom. So then Vs over Vg being so small, okay, I can throw that term out. So then this whole Gibbs free energy in this case is approximately, the Gibbs free energy of the solid is approximately equal to its Helmholtz free energy, because its specific volume is so small, and since the Gibbs free energy is the chemical potential, I can make this approximation. But the chemical potential of the solid is approximately equal to its Helmholtz free energy. You'll see why I'm making that approximation in a second. Are there questions so far? Okay. So what I can do now is take the absolute activity of the solid, lambda sub s, is e to the mu s over tau, and that's now approximately equal to e to the free energy over tau. That's why I wanted to make that approximation, that the free energy, the Helmholtz free energy, is roughly equal to the chemical potential inside the solid, right? This is not going to be true in the gas, just inside the solid, because the solid has such a small volume. So now that e to the free energy over tau is equal to e to the minus log of z, okay? And now you know how to take an exponential of a log, right? In this case, it's just going to be 1 over z. And we calculated that before. So this is e to the minus epsilon naught over tau times 1 minus e to the minus h bar omega over tau. So that's what the absolute activity is in the solid. Okay? So we just have to calculate that. Now, the gas we're assuming is ideal. We already know the absolute activity in that case. Okay, the absolute activity in the ideal gas is its density divided by nq. And then if I take the density, the density in the ideal gas, that's equal to p over tau, right? That's just your pv equals n tau relation. Okay, and then here I've substituted in what the quantum concentration was, nq being the quantum concentration. Okay, so this is just stuff that if you look up in previous lectures, right, we've already calculated what the absolute activity is of the ideal gas. In equilibrium, I should set those two equal to each other, because in equilibrium, the chemical potentials equal each other, okay? So lambda g equals lambda s, so now I can set this equal to this over here, okay? And I get that, let's take this equation first, pressure, okay, over tau and q will equal this stuff here, so then I multiply both sides by tau and q, and I get that the pressure is tau and q, this absolute activity of the solid. Now that I already did this part, now plug in what the quantum concentration was. The quantum concentration was m tau over 2 pi h bar squared, all of that to the 3 halves. So then I just plug that in. Okay. You see I had a tau to the 3 halves combined with a tau to make a tau to the 5 halves. Okay. So you see where we've gone. I just calculated the pressure versus temperature curve for solid to gas sublimation. Okay. So this is for the solid vaporizing directly into gas, and this should be the coexistence curve, basically. Any questions? Okay. We started off with conditions for equilibrium, chemical potentials, the pressures, the temperatures are equal. We made a very good approximation that the volume per molecule in the solid was very small compared to the volume per molecule in the gas. We also assumed the gas was ideal. So given all that stuff, here's your coexistence curve. And here's the plot, okay, I should have labeled this. This is pressure on this side, this is temperature on this side, okay, so this is solid to gas, all right. And here, it looks very much like what we've been showing for the the pressure temperature diagram of solid going to gas for water, for example. Okay, so it really does work. This curve right here is this curve there. Okay, and you know we derived a curve that you know you could take all the way up to there, but at some point the liquid will intervene and cut off the curve. Are there any questions?
Just wondering how do we derive the other curves in the same manner as we did for this one?
You can use similar principles to derive the rest of them. Yeah. So the solid we know how to describe, little harmonic oscillators. The gas we know how to describe. The liquid is a little bit subtle.
Gas, how would you be the same argument?
Well, the gas is an ideal gas. And so you know everything about the ideal gas by now. You know all the equations that apply to an ideal gas. And then the solid, we assume, is a little collection of harmonic oscillators inside there. So we have good approximations for those. The liquid is the hard one, honestly, because you know we've already made the point that the gas and the liquid are not all that different to begin with anyway, because a liquid and a gas have the same symmetries. The atoms can run around. And I only get a liquid to gas transition if I'm at low pressures. If I take the system to high pressures, I can't even tell the difference. So this one's, basically in order to get there, you need to have a description of the liquid. Liquids are a bit hard to describe. Okay. But the principles are the same. This is exactly what you would do. You would say they're in thermal, mechanical, and diffusive contact. So they have the same temperature, pressure, and chemical potential. Okay, so same principles would apply. So if I gave you, for example, equations that describe the liquid, then you could do the same analysis.
Okay. I was just wondering, because the curves at least look very similar, right? They have the same type of...
Here and there, yeah.
Right. Would that mean that the liquid can also be pretty much...
Oh, you mean here?
Yeah.
No. You know, we also derive this for one dimension. And I'm comparing it to a three-dimensional picture, but the general trend is correct. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. This looks morally the same. It's not clear to me exactly why. I mean, the liquid is a little bit denser than the gas, but I wouldn't go saying that the liquid necessarily obeys harmonic oscillator physics for each atom in the liquid. Any other? Yeah.
From this equation, can we actually derive the bounds of like how we piece these together then?
You mean
because we derived an equation for the sublimation
right,
line.
Right.
And we also
so we know this line.
Yeah, and we also derived an equation for the liquid to gas line.
Okay.
Like I was just wondering if looking at this equation, we'd be able to tell where the boundary is.
Does this tell us where the triple point is?
Yeah.
You know what? To really get the triple point right, you should do a slightly different analysis. To really get the triple point correct, where the three coexist together, what you need to look at there is the free energy of each phase. And what's going on when you have a phase transition is that the free energy of one phase is now starting to beat the free energy of the other phase. Okay. And depending on the conditions that you control, temperature, pressure, volume, that sort of stuff, you will use a different free energy, right? So if you're controlling pressure, temperature, and volume, temperature, volume, and number, right, then you want to use the Helmholtz free energy. If you're controlling pressure, you want to use the Gibbs. So you compare those two free energies. When one beats the other, that's when you know the phase transition has happened. So when you have three phases all close together in a phase diagram, that's the analysis I would do to make sure that you did things correctly. Because just this analysis here would tell you that this curve marches on up past its point of validity.
Yeah.
Okay, past some point beyond which, the liquid really became the stable thing right there. Okay. Any other comments? Okay, so anyway, that was our solid gas equilibrium line. So for the ideal gas, we said that PV equals N tau, and there are two main assumptions that went into that. We said we were always working in the limit where that was dilute and there weren't very many interactions. So that's equivalent to saying, look, my particles are point particles, okay, and they don't interact with each other. Okay. Now, we saw that for certain noble gases that are dilute, that's an okay approximation to make, all right? But you do start to notice, if you get a dense enough gas, you start to notice that this isn't quite correct. The particles aren't point particles, they take up a finite volume, and they do interact a little bit with each other. So what we'd like to do today is correct these, okay? Start correcting those assumptions. And see what happens. And the answer was told to us by this guy, van der Waals, okay? And he got a Nobel Prize for his van der Waals equation of state, which is one step correction to the ideal gas law by correcting those assumptions that I just said. We'll put in a little bit of interaction and let the size of the particle be finite as opposed to zero. And that was his PhD dissertation. Well, I'd like to get a Nobel Prize for my PhD dissertation, but anyway. But you know, just as a point of interest here, he started off as a school teacher, and he kept trying to get into graduate school, but he couldn't get into graduate school. So he kept failing the entrance exam. So for 11 years, he was trying to get in and couldn't get in. And he basically, they had a requirement of you know, knowledge of the classics, okay? So he didn't know that well enough, so he couldn't get into graduate school. But anyway, by the time he finally got in, you know, obviously he was ready to do brilliant work, right? So, one thing that's wrong with the ideal gas, okay, is this assumption of point particles. Okay, so here are the two assumptions we're working with. So first we'll cross this one off, that they're point particles. So the gas particles, really, each of them has a finite volume. Now it's small, right? And the volume of a particular atom is pretty darn small, right? It's about an angstrom wide. Okay, so this is a very small volume we're talking about. But what that means is that as far as the gas particles being able to together explore the entire volume available to them, they actually can't quite, okay? If this gas particle is here and this gas particle try to meet, that means that this gas particle here can't get into that volume, okay? So that's what we're talking about. There's a volume that's blocked off. Okay, so there's a slightly smaller volume available to be explored. So really we want to take the volume that we're used to talking about and subtract off that core volume. It's going to be a very small correction factor. So there's some minimal volume, meaning you can't quite do this, but if I could take all the atoms and just crush them and stick them all together, well, I could put them in the solid phase, would be good enough, right? But crush them, stick them all together, what's that total volume? N times B, okay? So number of particles times some minimal volume per particle. So the first modification we'll do is we'll take PV equals N tau and we'll correct the volume a little bit. Subtract off this little bit that can't be explored. Okay, and this is a small correction, but it's there. Got that one? So now the fact that there aren't interactions should also be controlled for a little bit. So if I have high pressures or high densities, then the particles do get close enough to each other to start noticing each other. They do interact a little bit. And what van der Waals pointed out is that if they're close enough together, they're actually often a little bit sticky, okay? They actually do, this is why things tend to form a liquid phase, is that they're a little bit sticky, and they pull apart, a little bit sticky, and they pull apart. And that might be a little bit counterintuitive because the outer shell of any atom is electrons, and electrons repel. Okay, so that's definitely there. There is a repulsion. But on the other hand, if you think about an atom as a snapshot, so let me think about a complicated atom that has a big nucleus and many electrons running around it. If I take a time average picture of this electron, it's usually pretty much spherically symmetric. Okay, but if I take an instantaneous photograph of it, okay, instantaneous photograph, what I'll see is that the electron cloud is shifted a little bit off the center of the nucleus. It fluctuates around, okay, so they fluctuate around each other and oscillate and that sort of thing. But any particular snapshot will show it's just a little bit off, okay? And if the electron cloud is just a little bit off from the nucleus, that means there's a dipole moment there. There's a net negative charge which is shifted just a little bit away from the net positive charge of the nucleus, gives you an instantaneous dipole moment. Does that make sense? Okay, so atoms have fluctuating dipole moments. There's no net dipole moment, but it's fluctuating. Now, what happens is one atom then approaches another atom, okay, is that they start to notice these fluctuations. And if I had a dipole pointed up and a dipole pointed down, the way that they would prefer to approach each other is anti-parallel to each other. Okay, so they actually would attract each other in this orientation. So what atoms do is they notice this. One atom gets close to another atom and starts seeing that fluctuating dipole moment of the other atom. And so what it'll do is it'll start fluctuating its own dipole moment opposite, okay? And that dynamic fluctuating dipole moment causes an attraction. It's weak, and they only notice it at very close scales, okay? But it's there. So that's the little bit of attraction we're talking about. Those are what's called van der Waals forces. That's what causes the particles to be a little bit sticky, and we'll talk about that more at the end of class. Yeah?
Why do they start attracting when they're fluctuating?
Well, the thing is that the dipole moments tend to want to anti-align when they're next to each other. Dipole moments just mean a plus charge is slightly separated from a minus charge. So if I had a plus charge and the electron charge was uniformly distributed, there's no dipole moment. A dipole is where I have a separation between a plus charge and a minus charge. And so if two dipoles are getting close to each other, they'll tend to want to orient this way. Basically, opposites attract, so that's how they want to orient themselves to lower their energy. Whereas if I put the plus up here and the minus down here, that's a higher energy state. So the atoms will notice as they get close to each other that they can lower their relative energy, and things are, you know, physics is always into lowering its energies. They can lower their energies if they start fluctuating their dipole moments in concert. Okay? One flips up, the other one flips down. Actually, I keep drawing it that way, but it's not drawing, but I keep showing it that way. It's not quite correct. It's more like this. Okay? And they're actually completely anti-correlated, if that makes sense. Okay? One fluctuates this way, and the other one adjusts. Okay? All right. So they just do that spontaneously because it'll be a lower energy state. And that ends up enhancing their attraction. So this is what causes molecules to get sticky when they get close enough together. So the fact that they attract each other, okay, now they attract each other, that means that as they're coming close to each other, there's a little bit of acceleration. Okay, so they're approaching each other with a particular velocity. Now they start to feel attraction and they whack into each other harder than you thought they would. So if they're going to do that, if they're going to whack into each other harder than you thought they would, then there's a correction factor that I should put into the pressure, because the pressure is the force per area with which they're going to hit each other. So slight correction factor here due to the fact that they're sticky. Now, all right, how should I say this? Okay, all the particles are always interacting with all the other particles, but the most important interactions are going to be pairwise interactions. That is, on average, you know, when this particle gets pretty close to this particle, they're probably the closest two particles. Okay, it is possible to have three particles participating all at once, but you need three of them to get in their vicinity to do that. So we're going to take pairwise interactions here, okay, and say that the correction factor then has to do with how many ways can I take the gas and randomly, you know, have it moving around and have little pairs close to each other. So the correction factor there is from the pairwise interactions, meaning I take all n particles, choose two, okay, which is n times n minus 1 divided by 2. For n very large compared to 1, that's approximately n squared over 2. So we're looking for some correction factor that basically goes like that. Okay. So the pressure will get corrected by some extra amount due to the stickiness according to the density squared. Okay. And A is just some constant of proportionality. So you could argue this another way, which is that I need a density near another density to get this interaction happening. So So we'll correct the pressure a little bit. Okay, where little n is big N per volume. So here we go. First thing we did was we corrected the volume. Volume went to V minus NB. N is the number of particles. B is the average volume per particle. Sorry, average dense volume of the particle itself. And we'll correct the pressure a little bit. Okay, pressure gets a constant here. I have a sign error here. See that? There, that minus sign should be a plus sign up in there. Okay. It's correct in the bottom half of the slide. The top part of the slide here needs a plus sign right there. P plus N squared A. Okay? So here's the modified ideal gas law so far. We have a pressure that got modified by making it a little bit larger according to NN interactions, pair one particle with another particle interactions. Pressure was a little bit higher because the molecules are sticky at close range. The volume's a little bit reduced because there's a core volume to each atom. So this atom can't explore the volume that the other atom takes up. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So we usually end up rearranging this a little bit. Into the following. Basically, solve it for pressure. So you see how to solve this equation for pressure. Divide both sides by V minus NB. Okay. So there's the N tau over V minus NB. And then I'll subtract N squared A over V squared from both sides. And that's the van der Waals equation of state. Okay. So why don't I bother correcting the volume here? This V squared.
Well, if the correction's really small, then squaring the correction would be even smaller.
Exactly. So it's there. I can also correct this volume. Okay. But it's a higher order correction. Yeah. Any questions about this? This is basically van der Waals slight improvement. Well, okay, very good slight improvement to the ideal gas law.
Yeah, Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem very impressive.
Well, not when you boil it down to this. But the idea of the fluctuating dipole moments giving you an attraction is actually pretty key as well. So, and this is, okay, so when people say van der Waals equation of state just means the thing that tells you what happens in the state. So when we say ideal gas law, that's the equation of state of the ideal gas. So when we say van der Waals equation of state, just think ideal gas law replacement, okay? So this is ideal gas law replacement. Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay. Yeah. That was the quick, easy, hand-wavy way, and then we'll go back and do it more rigorously. Question?
Well, I'm just kind of a little confused about how we got the correction of pressure of n squared over 2 to n squared over n squared times a over b squared. I mean, I understand a is like some constant, but...
Right. So the 2 doesn't matter, because I can absorb a 2
into the A.
The N squared matters because pressure is intensive. So if I'm going to correct pressure by some fact that goes like N squared, it's not quite legal. I need to turn it into something intensive.
Okay, so it's proportional to N squared.
That's right.
Okay.
So that's right. So we argue that it's proportional to N squared to get an intensive quantity, I'll have to normalize the N by the volume.
Okay.
So that's where it came in. So this is the intuitive, hand-wavy explanation of it, and then we'll go back and do a more rigorous explanation after the break. But let's take a 10-minute break. Come back at 2:30.
Yeah.
What if you move the mouse really fast?
What if rather than using a red beam of light, you used a gamma ray?
They have lasers really now instead of infrared.
Maybe infrared.
The mice now, instead of using infrared, they use lasers. It's true.
It's like 3 times more energy.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, there's such a large
margin of Friday.
I mean, because you need such a small margin of error in order to click icons on your desktop.
But what if you're a graphic designer?
Or a gamer.
Let's be honest, that's your choice. I was trying to come up with a reason.
Steal it. She won't notice.
Look at you.
I'll probably notice. I'll probably get in trouble too.
But I wouldn't get in trouble, so. That.
Where were you Monday?
I wasn't here.
Yeah, are you
all? I was home.
Yeah, something like that.
I'm sorry, Anna wasn't here. I
think it would be awesome to cover my steering wheel in that stuff.
Yeah, they had to sell steering wheel covers in that.
Like, seriously, or shift knobs, like stuff like that.
Might cause wrecks. Might cause wrecks, though. It might cause wrecks.
I'm eating in your car and talking.
I'm sorry, I thought that was one word, and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense.
When you get into an accident, they'll be like, look, he was holding the steering wheel. Not at the 10 and 2 o'clock.
Now I was thinking of me turning and going, wow, look at the pretty colors. Crash.
turn into a wall.
I used to have a shift knob that everybody used to like play with while I was driving. It drove me nuts.
That's really not good.
Well, like I had this little like I had a skull, and every time you touch him, his lights or his eyes would light up in red.
This was. This is your gear shift handle?
Yeah,
it was
a
lighted skull.
Yeah, it was a lighted skull. It was pretty cool, except everybody kept touching it while I was driving. I'm like, can you not do that?
I couldn't get my shit. That's pretty cool.
Oh, well, mine didn't use a battery. Mine had wires that ran down the end and connected to the 12-volt power supply.
Did anyone want one of those?
I didn't have to actually, like...
Yeah.
No, it didn't need one.
After wiring my entire radio and everything, I don't care about wiring in my car anymore.
You like the wires just sticking out everywhere.
But actually,
I have a ham radio antenna in my car, so if you screw on this big, you can screw this big old antenna to the back of the trunk, right? And then, of course, have a wire running through the trunk, under the back seats, and under the front seat, and then it's a little connector.
I have that due for my subs.
For what?
For my subs. I have wires running through my car, like, all over the place.
Do you have a ham radio?
Well, I have a handheld ham radio, okay, and then I can plug it into that antenna when I'm in the car, so then you get better reception, because your car is made of metal, and so then it acts like a Faraday cage, so your options are hang your head out the window with the radio, so the antenna gets better reception, or
plug it in. We had a radio like that, we used it to block off a 4-lane road.
How?
Well, we were talking to each other, and they were like, hey, everybody, line up and we'll block the road with a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit, and we were all going 20 miles an hour just to piss off people.
Good job.
That's why they should make more entertainment things in certain places.
That's right, yeah, that's right. Bored physics majors are dangerous physics majors. Right. There was a... where I was an undergraduate, the different dorms were a bit like fraternities, except everybody had to be in one, so they were more inclusive. But anyway, that ended up being your home and where you ate dinner and stuff. And so you were supposed to take a class picture every year with your people from your house, is what we called it, right? So there was one, it's not what my class did, but anyway, some other house had this clever idea that they would go block the 10 freeway in Los Angeles, which is several lanes, six lanes, okay? They did exactly what you're talking about.
A freeway?
They got six cars lined up, slowly slowed down, the entire class packed out, sat on the front of the cars and got this picture of the entire backed up freeway.
They probably...
And then ran away before they could get caught. We're talking 30 seconds, you know? Okay, everybody out, take the picture, we're out of here. Go. But they would if you blocked them. They would very quickly get people on them stuck, right?
No, like, we don't usually when we go out, there's nobody on it.
California.
Where's we? Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago. The suburbs.
Okay. Every time I drive through Chicago, I hate the freeway.
Like if you go later at night. Like, seriously, one time...
If you go on any expressway at, like, 3 in the morning...
No, it was, like, 11 o'clock, and my friend and I were doing, like, 90, and this cop comes up and just drives with us for a mile and then flies off. That was the only car we saw for about, like, 50 miles.
Okay, I would not be doing 90 in the vicinity of a cop.
Speed limit was, like, 55.
Oh, well! Then you were well below the speed.
Actually, I wouldn't drive 90 at all, but... Okay.
No, well, actually, he wasn't looking for us anyway. We got passed by the UTI students like a little while before that. And they usually do about 120, 130 on the way. So, we were going safely underneath what they were doing.
Maybe 10.
Yes.
I would have been like,
I'm going to have to miss class next Wednesday.
Okay. Okay.
Mornings aren't anything.
Because he
is there some time I could talk to you about California?
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah.
I am under the impression that, like,
my Wednesday office hours are usually not that crowded.
That's probably.
I'm going to come by early during the Wednesday office hour.
Okay. What time is that?
4:30. Yeah, 4:30 to 5:30.
Like,
all
right.
Yeah.
Come
back. Yeah. Or just if that doesn't work out, make an appointment. Email right. Me for an appointment. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about it.
That's just the best because it's third. Just the nuclear part should go in the top.
Jonathan has 30 seconds to get back to McDonald's. Huh? Oh, he's like a rack. Oh, he's close to starting. Let's get started again. By the way, my problem with my pointer is that the batteries were running out. That was my problem. So I have new batteries now. My pointer works. Hopefully it's going to keep working. So what I'd like to look at now is under these two assumptions, we'll let the particles have finite volume rather than zero volume, and let the particles be a little bit sticky when they get close to each other, so it'll affect the pressure. That'll change the free energy as well. So here's the ideal gas relation for the free energy. Okay, it's minus n tau times log of nq over n plus 1. We've derived that. And let's see how it changes under these two conditions. Okay, so the particles have finite volume. We'll let the volume then that can be explored get shifted a little bit by v goes to v minus nb, where n was the hard core volume per particle. And that'll adjust the Helmholtz free energy. So we start with the ideal gas relation here for the free energy, and just shift the volume. So the volume now that can be explored is a little bit less than what it was by the same factor nb. Now there's another change that happens, which is that the particles are sticky, which ends up basically adding an interaction energy to things. Okay, and it's basically a negative, well, it's a bit like a negative interaction energy because they're sticky. So the pressure gets shifted by p plus n squared over a, which is the same as p plus n squared over v squared a. And again, the way that we reasoned that was that it depended on two particles being in the same place at the same time. So it depends on the density times the density, again, being in the same spot. And we had to make sure that this was an intensive correction. So if I say it's n squared, I need to divide by v squared again to make sure that I get something that's intensive. And then a is some correction factor that we're not going to calculate that will depend on the particular gas that you're looking at. And then the interaction energy of attraction reduces the free energy. Because the free energy was the internal energy minus tau sigma. So if the internal energy is lowered because of an attraction, the free energy will also be lowered by the same amount. So that's what I'd like to figure out, is what's that shift? And the shift we can basically get from the fact that the pressure needs to be related to minus df by dv. So if there is a shift in the pressure of this much, of n squared a over v squared, that means there must have been some shift in the free energy of minus n squared a over v. That way, when I take the derivative of this, I'll get that term back for the pressure. When I take minus d by dv of this term, I get that term for the pressure. So we're just working backwards a little bit, saying, look, this is an interaction energy. Here's how it shifts the free energy. Does it make sense that it's a negative in the free energy? Okay, because energies of attraction lower the energy. So that shift is also there. So altogether, what those shifts, but the changes in the ideal gas equation of state meant, we're looking at a van der Waals case, van der Waals gas, is that I take the ideal gas law. Whenever I see the little n here, which is number per volume, I shift the volume by that core volume of a particle. And then I also shift the free energy by an overall interaction energy. So here's where it all shows up in here. Are there any questions about that? So to summarize, here's a shift here due to the fact that the particles actually have finite volume and not zero volume. And here's the shift here from the fact that the particles are a little bit sticky. So there's an attractive, weak attractive interaction. Now, why are they sticky? This is the little Geico guy. I really wanted to get the one of them doing the robot, but that wasn't very good. I'm sorry. So, why are they sticky? All right, so van der Waals forces, as we were saying earlier in class, this was a nice animated GIF that doesn't, of course, show up if you do the PDF file. Oh, well. We'll see. I'm wondering if I have a previous version of this from earlier, from last year.
The website's on, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, we're gonna go to the website. But
secret.
That right here, secret's a secret. that talk is called The Secret Life of Electrons in High Temperature Superconductors. There we go. All right, this one's gonna have the animated gift. Yeah, there we go. All right, wasn't that worth it? Okay. All that's going to do is distract. Well, I did do it with my hands earlier, but now it's, there it is in an actual animated cartoon. All that's going to do is distract you while I give you the explanation. But what it's what we said before, that an atom has a fluctuating dipole moment because the electron cloud is not always instantaneously right over the nucleus. So what's happening here is they're showing you, look, as these guys get close to each other, when these electrons get on this side of the nucleus over there, these guys also tend to polarize as well in response, because that'll lower the energy. So then their dipole moments, which are instantaneous, will tend to fluctuate together so as to lower the total energy of the system. So they really do react like that when they get close together. That's the van der Waals attraction. That might be worthy of a Nobel Prize. Is that going to work, getting a Nobel Prize?
I don't know. It seems like that's a lot
more now. Not if you're on the committee. All right.
Well, I have that to, like, decode the human genome.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the bar's a little higher. Yeah.
We already figured out all these.
Way to go, guys.
So the van der Waals attraction will kick in as the atoms get close enough. Okay. Now, the reason that it... Well, okay. I mean, why isn't this working at longer distances is a good question. If it's there... Yes?
Is it because at longer distances, the electron... Coulomb interaction is stronger repulsion?
I think it's because the dipole has...
It's always there. Oh, I see. Stronger than left. Aha! The dipole-dipole interaction falls off faster. Very cool. Yes?
Yeah, dipoles are too.
Okay. But that's one reason. What were you going to say?
The same thing.
Falls off faster. Yeah. I was going to say
is the R squared, you just subtract the two differences, and it's going to be such a minor thing, actually, so far out.
Yeah. The dipole is short-lived, too. That matters as well. There's also the fact that the dipole moment itself is pretty small, in the sense that if I think about taking a Gaussian box around this thing, so... What's going on here is the dipoles get close to each other. You care about how close they are this way compared to what's the dipole length itself, right? Because the dipole moment is the charge difference times the distance between the two. I mean, everything you guys have said is correct, but this is part of why the dipole interaction falls off faster than one over r. So here is a particular different distance between the positive and the negative parts of the dipole. And so if these guys get close enough compared to that distance, then when this negative charge sees the effects of the other negative and positive charge, it feels the electric field lines from this guy, it feels the electric field lines from this guy, and it can tell the difference. If they're sufficiently far apart, okay, if this is the same thing minus and plus, there's a negative charge over here, and it's trying to tell the difference between electric field lines coming from these two points, they're more or less going to cancel by the time they get there. So you really only start feeling them when you're in a distance range that approaches the size of the dipole length itself. Okay. So anyway, either way you want to look at it is fine. It's the same underlying physics. Question? Yeah? Okay. So the fact that the length of the dipole moment plays into how strong this effect is means that bigger molecules can have bigger dipoles. So larger molecules will have larger van der Waals forces, and long skinny molecules, okay, will also have larger dipole moments available to them. So this is part of why long skinny molecules tend to form more complicated phases, like liquid crystals or liquids, rather than staying in the gas phase, because those long molecules that are in liquid crystals, the molecules tend to be rod-like, for example. So that's a nice long axis for forming these fluctuating dipoles. So they can have larger van der Waals interactions with their neighbors and tend to be stickier and form liquid or liquid crystalline phases. And also, the larger the molecule, then the higher the melting point, because they have these sticky interactions that, again, depend on the size of the molecule. Any questions about that? No? Okay. I'm going to switch back to my other thing. There we go. Alright. since I've updated the gecko pictures. The gecko pictures are better this year. So, Van der Waals forces, it's been recently discovered that this is how geckos work. Okay, so geckos are these cute little lizard little guys, and they have the ability to walk on ceilings and walk on walls, which is something we'd all like to figure out how to do. And they're, I don't know if you've gotten the chance to see a gecko up close, but their feet are kind of funny the way that they lay down. The bottom of their foot is such that their toes can curl up like this. Okay, so a gecko puts its foot down and uncurls its toes like that, and then picks up the toes by curling them and sets it down again. So they curl and uncurl. Okay, I would demonstrate that the right way with my hand, but I can't bend my fingers that way. So what's happening is that the gecko foot is really sticky. The only way that it can get itself off is, you know, if you try, for example, I know you've done this with a Band-Aid, yeah? There's a difference between pulling a Band-Aid off yourself and going whack all at once, and that kind of hurts because it pulls a lot, or slowly peeling it off little bit by little bit, okay?
It just hurts for a long time.
Well, I know, but if you do it all at once, you get all of that attraction all at once that you're trying to fight. It's actually harder to get off than if you peeled it bit by bit. So the gecko uses the same principle. It'll uncurl its toe bit by bit so that it's not fighting the entire attractive force all at once. Just little by little, it's breaking it. So this guy is hanging upside down on the ceiling by virtue of his sticky feet. And his sticky feet are very complicated. So here are several different gecko feet. And you can see there's structure to them. Okay, so there's structure to the toes here. Several different species of geckos here. And if you zoom in on the one toe, so here are their feet. Here's a single toe. And if you zoom in onto these little bits here on the toe, you can almost see in this picture that they're looking a little bit hairy. They really are. They're little tips of hair coming off of the gecko toe. And so they're furry on the edge. But then the hair splits and splits and splits and splits and splits and splits. It's meant to be the most split-ended hair. And a single... call it a seedal tip. A single seedal tip will end in several very, very, very fine hairs at the end by the time it's gone through the split process to get something that's very, very fine. Now, the point of this is that Van der Waals attractions happen at close range, and they're maximized if you maximize the surface area. So the strategy here is that this now has a very large surface area, and the very fine hairs, when they make contact with any surface, no matter how rough or weird the surface is, the hairs can squish in and find lots of surface area to make contact with because the hairs are so fine that they just find a spot anywhere. So this is this is basically how gecko feet work. So we are going to go get the movie. I tried to download the movie, but you can't. It's a real audio thing. We have to actually go visit the website here.
Are those pictures on the website too?
The pictures are from all over the internet. If you want the actual attribute, I have them in the notes of my PowerPoint file. But I'll tell you, my trick was I went to Google Images and I searched for gecko feet. Bhakta, I should have done this test over the break to make sure that our sound is on. We have to restart this in a second to make sure the sound's on.
Awesome.
Like real player at the worst player.
How big is that? Oh, okay, no, it's gonna work.
You shouldn't.
We don't have sound yet. We'll get some sound. Hang on. Oh.
Is he dead?
That's so funny.
Did they just shoot a gecko on like
the millions of tiny hairs on gecko's toes bond with almost any surface, not because of some special glue.
Really?
Yeah. For serious. Like, or it's like with the four arrows pointing out.
Yeah, if you put your mouse over.
Put your mouse on the screen again.
Or you go to file.
In the black part of the screen.
And if you go to the black part of the screen, or you can even
there we go.
This gecko's feet are so sticky they could support the weight of a 250-pound man, but that stickiness doesn't keep it tied down either.
Gecko can run up a wall at 3 feet a second. These are really fast lizards. So how is it that they can stick and unstick their feet so rapidly?
The millions of tiny hairs on gecko's toes bond with almost any surface, not because of some special glue, but because of the size and shape of the hairs. What matters is not chemistry, but geometry.
It means that if we want to fabricate a gecko, we don't have to copy the precise biochemical nature of the very tips of those hairs.
Autumn's colleague, Ron Fearing, molded tiny, fake gecko hairs out of silicone rubber and polyester. Both stuck as well as real gecko hairs. Creating millions of these tiny hairs in large patches could lead to a new era in adhesives.
And this is an adhesive that is reversible. It sticks strongly, but you have to use it and doesn't leave a residue.
Such adhesives would also work underwater or in a vacuum, a huge benefit to the space industry. And they might even open the door for a new superhero.
I was on an airplane, and they were showing the movie Spider-Man, and I just couldn't help thinking that we could do that someday. I mean, I guess forget Spider-Man. I think we should have Gecko Girl instead.
Not bad for a lowly lizard. I'm best friend now.
That looks like an angry gecko.
That
one looked a little bit mad.
The gecko looks
so much nicer.
Well, did you see what his thumb press is? Like, the gecko's neck. Like, oh.
No geckos were harmed in the making of that.
What
was
the gecko that tried to move the costume?
It was just frustrating.
Right. So the fun part there.
Was the video.
Losing my laser pointer. So we already said this, that the long thin molecules can pack closer together than the spherical molecules. The surface area matters. And what's interesting here is that the van der Waals forces are weak, but significant. Okay, significant enough to be able to have a gecko walk on the ceiling. And the van der Waals forces are on the order of about 1% of the strength of a covalent bond, which is why they can be undone. You don't want to be trying to form an adhesive by forming covalent bonds. That means you're going to take the full strength of the material. So you want something slightly weaker than that if you're going to make a nice adhesive. Here, I don't know if you caught what this said on the video, that the gecko feet can hold a 250-pound person. So four gecko feet can hold a large person. So if you need to be James Bond sometime, stick some geckos in your pocket for handholds. You need to make sure you have strong geckos, because the thing that, you know, won't be the gecko feet themselves that break down, that doesn't work out. Might be rather the tensile strength of a gecko body that breaks down. So make sure you have a good strong gecko, or maybe give it some body armor or something if you're going to use it as a handhold. So there you go, that's what we did today. We finished solid gas sublimation, worked on van der Waals for a while. See, geckos are the best thing that happened to van der Waals in years. Van der Waals used to be kind of a boring subject, but now that we know that that's how gecko feet work, this is now very exciting.
We should give him another Nobel.
That's right, he needs another Nobel Prize for the geckos.
No way. Like a Nobel Peace Prize for bridging the gap between people and geckos.
So I have office hours today at 4:30, everybody.
Instead of Nobel Peace Prize for bridging the gap between humans and geckos.
I guess he gets what you get when you pay for it.
Yeah!
Yes.
So Julius went to the
Thanksgiving.
not evil, not other, not gecko, but some that kind of like a lizard or something. That thing's so smack.
Oh really?
The car is so weird. Yeah. Like the buff is rough and then the bottom is like the strike is a bit. So it looks like poisonous lizard.
Yeah.
No, just smell. I can't eat curry after I can't eat it. Curry smells.